The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bratfold, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Louise Dovery Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, April 13th, and we have three matters on the calendar for oral argument this morning. The first case is State of Minnesota versus Frankie Torres. Counsel, I know you are both familiar with our procedures. I'll just remind you that you will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And I will just remind anyone on the line that recordings of this proceeding are prohibited by our rules. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Juliana Passy on behalf of the appellant, State of Minnesota. Your Honors, in this case, the district court's grant of a dispositional departure to the respondent, Frankie Esquivel Torres, was not on the basis that he was particularly amenable to probation, was not supported by the record evidence, which demonstrated that Torres had a long history of pretrial and probationary violations, and that he had previously successfully completed treatment before continuing to commit further violations, pretrial violations. Under the circumstances of this case, the district court abused its discretion and granted a dispositional departure, and the state would request that this court reverse the grant of the departure and remand for resentencing. Obviously, as your honors are well aware, a departure requires substantial and compelling grounds for depart that are simply not here in this case. Particularly,
Ms. Passy, I want to make sure I understand your argument. I don't think you're disputing that particular amenability to treatment and also the basis that an offender is chemically dependent and is receptive to treatment, that those are invalid departure grounds. You're not claiming that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're claiming that on this record, there is no evidence to support application of or departing on either of those grounds.
Correct, Your Honor. So the district court's ground for departure was particular amenability to probation based on the chemical dependency factor of the sentencing guidelines. Certainly, the particular amenability to probation under Soto requires that the defendant be distinguished from most others in a way, and there's reasons that present substantial compelling circumstances to justify a departure. Here, there's just not that evidence for the district court. Mr. Torres has two prior felony convictions. He had a prior drug sale conviction, which is particularly concerning because this is another first degree drug sale conviction. In that drug sale conviction from 2006, he received a stay of imposition. And then he violated probation in 2007 and again in 2010 and was ultimately committed to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections in that case. There's also a very concerning history in this case, Your Honor, of pretrial violations. Mr. Torres was sentenced after a global plea was reached involving, I believe, seven files. He pleaded guilty to two offenses over those seven files. I believe 16 other felony counts were dismissed as a result of the plea. He was initially placed on pretrial supervision in the first case on July 23rd of 2019.
But Ms. Passy, let me just stop you there. I mean, the district court knew all of this and in fact acknowledged during the sentencing hearing his extensive record and the fact that he'd had setbacks before. Are you suggesting that the prior history in and of itself prevents a departure?
Your Honor, I am suggesting that the particular amenability to probation is required regardless. That takes into account all of these factors, the prior history, the pretrial release violations, the probation violations. The district court's view of the record it's true the district court judge was aware of Mr. Torres's history of pretrial violations. Her departure decision appears to be focused solely on the last several months of his.
But doesn't the district court focus on the fact that the appellant's criminal history and prior activity appeared to be drug related. And now he's gotten control of his drug dependency. So doesn't that focus it in on allowing the trial court not to ignore, but to not weigh heavily, not take his history and weigh it heavily against him when it's based upon drugs and he's now completed a program of treatment?
It is true, Your Honor, that the district court did focus. She did make that statement that she believed that his history was of crime was related to drugs. I don't believe, Your Honor, that in itself immunizes the past behavior. When you're looking for substantial reasons for depart, there are certainly Mr. Torres's history of offenses is particularly concerning, perhaps in a way that other people who have first degree drug convictions might not. There's also the essentially complete lack of pretrial. The district court seems to kind of just smooth over the, you know, it was like a year, 2 years, I believe, he was on pretrial release before he was finally sentenced on these files. The district court essentially erased the first year and a half and didn't take that into account in deciding that he was, in fact, particularly amenable to probation. I think it's also important to
I don't know that that's accurate, but I mean, it is clear that the district court focused on the period of time in April when she furloughed him to go to inpatient treatment that then progressed to outpatient and aftercare. Is there anything wrong with the court, you know, being persuaded by the record that exists in 5 months leading up to sentencing?
Your Honor, I believe that the State versus Soto case does suggest that the comprehensive view of the in totality of the circumstances regarding the defendant and his history, his background, is what it should be evaluated by the district court in making its departure decision. And that, I believe, is what the court did not do here. I think another important thing that the court overlooked is that Mr. Torres had, in fact, been previously furloughed to treatment over the summer of 2020, successfully completed treatment, and then apparently returned to the life of crime. He was in that fall of 2020, his conditional bail was increased several times, and then he was eventually arrested on December 18th of 2020 while being fleeing from police through the city of Wilmer at high speeds while a passenger dumped 50 grams of meth out the window.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I note that there was prior treatment, successfully completed prior treatment in 2020, but no indication, at least in the PSI, that there was an aftercare program as he participated in this past year. Doesn't that make a difference that he's been successful in that, not in an inpatient setting?
Your Honor, I think, the evidence provided by provided to the district court by the defendant at sentencing on the level of compliance in outpatient treatment was rather slim. As I recall, the defendant sent in treatment notes, which basically indicated that he had been attending treatment, outpatient treatment between July 13th, 2021, and I believe it's August 1st of 2021. So there's a month of treatment there that that was not provided to the district court of what went on between August 1st of 2021 and September 1st of 2021 when the sentencing occurred. I think there's also a concern based on there was no evidence provided to the district court that Mr. Torres had been, in fact, testing negative. That's certainly what his attorney told the court, that he had received word from the treatment provider that Mr. Torres was testing negative. but there was no actual record evidence provided to the district court. There was no documentation, and he was not required as a part of his pretrial release at that point to be testing for probation. So the district court didn't have any way to verify that. It essentially relied on Mr. Torres's word that he was in fact complying with probation, pretrial release in making that determination.
Well, wasn't there also a dispositional advisor that on behalf of defense counsel that, you know, reached out to the treatment providers, and I believe that person provided testimony or a statement to the district court. Are you suggesting the district court erred by relying on those representations?
Your Honor, the advisor did provide a memorandum to the district court that had a I believe some excerpts or some summarizing of what she read the records to say. I don't specifically remember that mentioning his testing, but certainly I think it would be better practice for the district court to require evidence, medical records to be provided to the district court rather than just relying on the a defendant's dispositional departure memorandum from someone who provides, you know, sections of medical records, but perhaps is cherry picking the parts that are most favorable to the defendant. And so I would suggest that there was not sufficient evidence for the district court regarding to make that finding that Mr. Torres had in fact been in complete compliance with pretrial release conditions in the 5 months when he was furloughed to treatment at the time of sentencing, for her to make that determination that he was in fact particularly amenable to probation in light of the extensive history of pretrial violations and probation violations that Mr. Torres had in fact incurred in the during these cases. There are no other grounds. The district court relied solely on the particular amenability probation and did not reach any other grounds of Mr. Torres. No other departure grounds. So I think that's the only departure that could be considered by this court. And in fact, his other factors would not support a departure. He was 34 years old at the time of sentencing.
Ms. Passy, will you remind me, please? Oh, did I freeze? Sorry. Will you remind me, please, the term of the stay for Mr. Torres that was imposed by the district court?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I believe it was 5 years, Your Honor, but I could be mistaken on that.
Okay. An extended period. And there are conditions, aren't there?
There are conditions. He is required to test as a condition of probation. He was sentenced to a year in jail. He was provided the ability to do electronic home monitoring with release to work as a result of that as well. So he certainly does have conditions that he is required to abide by now. It's the state's position, of course, that it's the looking back at the time of sentencing that's the problem. Is that
I understand. I understand your argument. And the district court also, I think the one other fact during this period of time that the district court emphasized, the 5 months from April until September, is that Mr. Torres did maintain employment as well, right? And made a move with his family from the Wilmer area to Moorhead.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is something that the district court appeared to take into consideration and seems to have.
And you would agree, I mean, based on your argument, you want the district court to look at the totality, right? All the circumstances in a comprehensive way. So you would want the district court, I mean, your argument would suggest that the district court was appropriately considering all of these things. Your argument, I think, is that the district court, in your view, weighed some of the facts more heavily than others.
Yeah, that's true, Judge Breffold. I believe that the district court did, you know, appropriately take into account the changes that Mr. Torres had made in his life. It's the state's position that those the recent changes are not sufficient in themselves, especially in light of the past 2 years on pretrial release, his lack of expression of any kind of remorse at the sentencing hearing. He's, you know, multiple offenses and just the complete. The record is clear that Mr. Torres was not amenable to probation, showed that over and over again on pretrial release for approximately 2 years or a year and a half before he was finally furloughed from jail. to treatment the second time. Just briefly, Your Honors, there are no grounds to withdraw the plea, which respondent suggests in their brief. There was no promise that the state would not appeal. Mr. Torres is, if he was granted departure, that the state would not appeal that, suggesting that the state is breaching somehow its agreement by appealing, is reading into this the plea agreement, a term that is not there. If Mr. Torres wanted the state not to be able to appeal, he could have bargained for that, and he failed to do so. He cannot try and retroactively try and put in a contract term when he is dissatisfied with the state's appeal. So in conclusion, I say I'm almost out of time. I would ask the court to reverse and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Passy. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Lauerman, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Jennifer Lauerman. I represent respondent Frankie Esquivel Torres. As Your Honors know, this court will not reverse a trial court's decision to depart unless the reasons given are improper or inadequate and the departure is not supported by evidence in the record. The district court judge who presided over this case from omnibus until sentencing. The district court judge gave proper reasons for the departure, which are supported in the record. The judge acted well within her discretion when she evaluated the information and testimony and determined that Torres was chemically dependent and particularly amenable to treatment. In Sanders, the Supreme Court recognized that the sentencing judge has a unique perspective on all stages of the case and is the person in the best position to evaluate the defendant's conduct and weigh the sentencing options. To be fair, as appellant said, the district court said in this case, ultimately, to me, it comes down to the decision I made earlier. But, and this is the important part, then on the record, the court weighed the decisions for and against a departure before arriving at a decision. The court noted...
One of my concerns about this case, Ms. Lauerman, is sort of the lack of evidence and the fact that the district court took the lack of evidence of positive UAs or you know, other kinds of problems in the course of treatment, both inpatient and outpatient. It does seem like the record is pretty skinny. I mean, I find a record from a couple of reports from Red River Recovery Center, one from back in May and one from early July, that seems to indicate that your client was participating in treatment and was not having any positive UAs. But then we have nothing in the record, do we, between that July 6th submission and sentencing? That seems like a big gap of time, given the fact that the district court focused so much on also a small period of time, the 5 months between furlough and sentencing. How do you respond to that concern about the record?
Mr. Torres did say at his sentencing that the district court didn't require him to do UAs, but then he talked on page 20 to 25 of the sentencing transcript about having done UAs at Red River and at Anchorage. So he testified to that. Also, Index 42, the letter from counsel that had treatment information and a copy of his lease that was filed, that discussed that he had complied with all expectations while he was in treatment up at Red River. So sure, the court didn't order it, but the defendant has testified that he did it and that he was successful, and there are treatment reports. Also, the counsel for Mr. Torres did testify that he was in contact with the probation officer that was supervising him. There is nothing in the record to show that he wasn't complying or that that person had any question about whether or not he was using illicit substances.
So you contend it's appropriate for the district court to rely on the defendant's own assertions and kind of third-hand information that the UAs that have been required by the treatment facility have all been negative.
This was a contested sentencing. The state had an opportunity to bring evidence if it wanted to try to prove that he was using or that he was not behaving. The state chose not to present that evidence. if they did it over, maybe they'd do something differently, but that's not where we're at. So the court acknowledged that my client had a history, but as Judge Klopaki commented earlier, the court also noted that most of his history had to do with being on drugs. The court acknowledged on page 24 that he had had 2 years of really bad use and really bad behavior. The court had multiple files. It had that in front of it. But if you look at Malinsky, the court can also consider his motive to finally reform despite prior failures on supervision. And that appears to be what the court did here. The court noted for departure that he's an addict and he's been an addict. And the court had indexes 21 and 22, the chemical dependency evaluation and the mental health evaluation to inform that decision. The court noted that he had had 6 years of abstinence that occurred when he was in Texas. And that can be found in index 21, the chemical dependency evaluation at page 9. And then it also occurs in index 48, the dispositional memo at page 2. So that's in multiple places in the record. And the court specifically brought that up at sentencing. The court noted on page 24, when it was reasoning, that he had been in full compliance with treatment and aftercare. That obviously happened since the furlough, but it's also noteworthy that that happened without him living in Wilmer, as was that 6 year period of abstinence. When he was in Texas, he was able to be abstinent. He came back to Wilmer. Things did not go well for him in Wilmer. Then he moved his family. He moved his treatment up to somewhere that wasn't Wilmer and did well. The court noted.
When did your client move to Moorhead? When was that?
I would have to double check in the record, Your Honor. I believe it was that Red River Recovery is up there and that he had stayed up in the area. So when he was furloughed, he moved his family and he was up there.
Because his prior treatment in 2020 was also up in the Moorhead, Grand Forks area, was it not?
Right. And the letter that was filed with the court, Index 42, that was filed on July 8th, included a copy of a lease. And had a copy of the lease for the Fargo Moorhead property. I don't have a copy of that lease. I don't know if it was an oversight of that it didn't come down when I downloaded that document, but that was available to the court, and it was at least by July that they had signed that lease. So, informing the court's finding that he was in compliance with treatment and aftercare, they had index 42, which is the letter from counsel, the treatment report and the lease. And then they had index 49, which is that treatment report from Anchorage. The court said, absent use, I don't see that he can't be a contributing member of society. He had verified employment in index 40, which is a letter from his employee or his employer, excuse me. And then index 58, at page 22, he testified at sentencing about his job and he testified about working. And so there are multiple ways to verify that the court verified that he had employment. Judge Bjorkman asked Ms. Passy if there's anything wrong with using the 5 months prior to sentencing to justify a departure. My answer to that question would be no. The courts do that a lot, where they'll give someone an opportunity to get out or to do treatment, and then they'll base their decision, at least partially, on whether or not that person's able to perform. Here, he was given a chance. He took advantage of that chance. He fully complied after that furlough with the court's intention and showed his dedication to reforming his life, despite the fact that he had a terrible track record. Judge Bjorkman, you mentioned that there was no aftercare in the other treatment. There was aftercare here. He had support in the community. He had a very supportive employer who help tailor his employment to his treatment needs. The record here shows that the court carefully considered the factors that were against. The court carefully considered the factors that were for. As I just pointed out, the court's findings are supported by the documents that are in the record. This court should affirm the decision. As the court said in Soto, it's the exceptional rare case where the reviewing court reverses the decision to depart. This is not that case. If you look at the record, it does support the court's decision. As far as whether or not my client should be allowed to withdraw his plea, I believe that the court should find, and I'm asking the court to affirm the district court, that issue need not be reached. If this court chooses to reverse and remand for a different sentencing decision, then we're asking to preserve that issue because the record here does not contain the plea transcript. And we would be conjecturing based upon a plea petition as to what my client believed or thought or what specifically was discussed on the record about the understanding of the terms of the plea agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Passy, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, Judge Bradfield, I want to correct my statement. He was placed on 10 years of probation. The concern you expressed, Judge Bjorkman, about the lack of evidence in the record. It is, of course, the defendant who was seeking the downward dispositional departure. He is the one who has to show that there's reasons in the record to depart dispositionally, why there are substantial and compelling reasons that this case is different than all the other first degree controlled substance sale cases. And so it was up to him to show those reasons, not the state to disprove those reasons. There is this, again, the lack of medical records is concerning. It seems the district court did rely somewhat on the statements of counsel, and counsel Ms. Lauerman did reference the statements of the district court the trial counsel in his representations to the court about his clients and his clients' apparent compliance with treatment and aftercare and doing what trial counsel thought was appropriate. Of course, the statements of trial counsel are not evidence for the district court to take into consideration to the extent that she did. I would submit that that is error.
Isn't part of the problem the lack, to the extent there's a lack of evidence? I mean, on attributable to the fact that the district court did not, as conditions of release, require UAs or some other way to demonstrate, abstinence. I mean, well, how's a defendant supposed to deal with that?
Well, I think how they deal with that, Your Honor, is in this case, for example, the PSI did raise that issue. It said that he has not been required to submit to UAs under the district court's release order. Therefore, we don't have a way to verify that. And so that kind of stoked the issue. And apparently the defense counsel saw that and was concerned about it enough so that he made that phone call and gave that third-hand information to the court about the treatment provider says that my client is complying with what he's supposed to be doing. The proper thing to do would be for the defendant to get those treatment records, to provide a verified statement, to get an affidavit and provide that to the court rather than just taking trial counsel, saying that to the record. That's not evidence for the court. And certainly Mr. Torres, he did make a statement to the court. He admitted he wasn't taking UAs. He did say he was complying through treatment. I don't believe his statement was a verified statement. And again, I don't know that that's sufficient evidence or should be sufficient evidence for the district court to rely on a defendant's word in the absence of substantial documents that are supporting that statement.
But there wasn't any dispute that he was continuing with the aftercare program, right? I mean, isn't that reflected in the PSI that he was doing aftercare?
That is correct, Your Honor. It is reflected in the PSI, and there was a treatment notes, Your Honor, that were submitted to the district court. I believe they were handed in at the sentencing hearing themselves, with treatment dates from July to August 1st of 2021, which basically say that he created a treatment plan and had attended sessions. So that's what the district court had on hand. It doesn't say anything about testing that I can see on that document. So I think there was a problem here with the district court relying on in the lack of evidence in this case of compliance with treatment is particularly troubling in light of Mr. Torres's very troubled history of pretrial and probationary violations. I don't think it's enough for the district court just to rely on his statements and the lack of corroborating evidence. So I would suggest that the district court did abuse its discretion in granting the dispositional departure in this case. And I would ask the court to reverse and remand for resentencing.
Thank you, Ms. Passy. Thank you both for your arguments today.